What I would really love to do, I thought, was to sort of tell an ancient Indian epic for young people.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm Graham McQueen, and I taught at McMaster University for about 30 years. And then I took what's called early retirement, which means in my case that I got tired of being a professor and decided to do other things that I wanted to do for a while. So I decided I'd always wanted to write a novel, and when a publishing company in India asked me to write a novel for young people in India, I thought, wow, I never thought of that before. I think I'll try.
That's how it started.
It was published by Tulika, which is run by two women based in Chennai. And they run this wonderful publishing company with a lot of progressive, what we would think of as progressive literature, talking about the environment and social justice and women's issues and all kinds of stuff. And so they liked the book, and I liked them, and that's who brought it out. So the book, in the end, is called Journey to the City of Six Gates. And I think it's for what we call young adults. But who knows? It may be that little kids might appreciate it. And I know that some adults like it too.
What is the book about?
What is the book about? Whoa, that's an interesting one. Well, I got to tell you, I didn't know what it was going to be about when I started writing it. Can I start there?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know if I would have a story to tell. So I just went to the library, Health Sciences Library at McMaster. I remember very clearly. And I went down to the lower floor, some blank paper, and just started to write to see if there was a story that would start to come out. And there was. Suddenly there was a boy. His name was Satya, and he was walking around, and I thought, okay, this feels good. And I think initially I gave him a sister because probably I thought, well, you know, girls will want to read this too, so let's give him a sister. And his sister didn't really have any personality initially. She was just the sister. And the more I wrote, the more this sister started to take over the story. Her name was Mati, and she became a very, very concrete, vivid, I think, character. And she ends up kind of stealing the show. So anyway, I won't tell the whole story, but the gist of it is that Mati and her brother, Satya, are the princess and prince in a certain kingdom in India. And this kingdom is invaded by a very greedy king. And they're forced to run away. And they end up being taken through the forest as they flee to the kingdom of a good king where they can take refuge. And they're taken on this journey by a man named Jaya, who's a famous bowman, an archer. And so the three of them, Jaya, Mati, and Satya, have this long journey, and that's why it's called Journey to the City of Six Gates, as they try to escape from the evil kings who want to get them. And as they go on this journey, they develop special powers. And Satya learns to be able to move through the trees, through the tops of the trees. And Mati learns to be able to talk to the trees and to figure out what the trees are feeling. Mm. But of course, when you get special powers, you also sometimes have to be wounded. And So they also go through some very tough times, and they have to recover from their wounds, and they have to learn a lot and grow up. And so it's about their painful struggles as they go through this long journey. Okay, so let me try and give a little background here. So our three heroes are fleeing through the forest, and they meet a terrible area, terrible place called the Thicket of Itch, where everybody, you know, itches, gets very, very itchy. I won't give away the story, so I won't tell too much about what happens there. But anyway, Mati goes into a very deep, sad space after that for a while. And it takes her quite a while to recover because, you see, she's very sensitive to trees. And when anything bad happens to trees, she feels it very deeply. So at this point in the story, this is fairly well on in the story, Mati has discovered her true name. She knows who she really is, and she knows what her task is. But she has gone to the top of a hill and looked over, and she had this really bad feeling as she was climbing the hill. She knew that she was going to see something really bad on the other side. And there, on the other side of the hill, as far as she could see, was what we would nowadays call clear-cutting going on. All the trees, all the way to the horizon, were chopped down. And there was smoke coming up and men chopping down trees. And she was so stunned and shocked by this that she fainted. Mm-hmm. So that's how the last chapter ended. It ended with Mati fainted and lying on the ground. And now this little passage I'm going to read is what happens after that. Down a hill, a young woman was crawling on her hands and knees. She was moving very slowly, dragging a little bundle after her. It was Mati. When she had regained consciousness after fainting, she had tried hard to remember the things the old woman in the hill nation had taught her. "There is a right way and a wrong way to do these things," the old woman had said. "You must not injure yourself." Mati remembered that there was a stream that wound around the foot of the hill, and she remembered what the old woman had told her to do. The sun burned the back of her neck, and her throat was dry as dust. She tried not to think about what she had seen over the hill. "To the stream," she said to herself. "To the stream." And then there it was, running fast between its banks. She left her bundle with her green cloak inside on the bank, and she slipped into the water. She drank, she floated, she let the water wash the pain out of her mind. Then she went to a shallow place where she could kneel. With her head bowed and her knees on the smooth pebbles, she held both her hands in front of her. Her hands were cupped and were filled with water from the stream. She waited until her hands stopped shaking, until the water in each palm was still and smooth as glass. She let her mind become like the water in her palms. She reached out softly with her mind, searching for the minds of the trees. She heard their pitiful little words, "Good things, forever." But she did not stop there. She went deeper. She found what she was looking for. Mati found fear. She found terror in the trees. She felt it spill into her. Her hands began to shake again. Then she remembered what she had to do, and she whispered to the trees, "Give me your fear, and let it flow through me. Give me your fear, and I will set it free." Oh, the fear went through her like boiling water. She opened her mouth and closed her eyes. The boiling river ran through her for a long time, and then gradually it became a stream, and then the stream became a trickle, and she felt the minds of the trees touch her own mind, like fingers, groping, wondering, discovering. She heard a murmur all around her, the sound of many voices growing louder. "Who is it? Who are you, Two-Foot? Are you the one who arises? And Mati, her hands cupped and her eyes closed, said, I am Mati the Green, keeper of the vow to protect the canopy, who has crossed the river of doubtful crossing, who has escaped from the bog of no escape, who has burned down the 100,000 signs, who has come over the mountains to let the vow blossom. Oh, with a great cry, the forest raised its head in wonder. An elephant trumpeted, a lion roared, crows cawed as they sprang from treetops and filled the air. Snakes stirred the leaves as they came out of holes in the ground. Small animals rustled in the bushes. The wind was blowing. The tops of the trees were swaying. Say it! Say the vow, Mati, sang the trees with one voice. We have cried danger into the night and have heard nothing but the echo of our own voices. This is the time. This is the time right now. Say the vow to protect the canopy. And Mati poured the water from her hands back into the stream. She opened her eyes and stood up. She put on her green cloak. She stood tall in the stream and turned her face to the sun, spread her arms and cried out with a strong, clear voice, On the day the canopy feels danger, on the day the canopy decides, on the day the canopy sends out word, I will be bark over the sapwood, I will be thorns against blades, I will be water against fire. I will look on the life of the canopy as my own life. By the thirst in the root, by the joy of the world tree, I make this vow.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
See, when I was asked to write a story for young people in India, my initial reaction was, no, I can't do it, because I don't know the reality of ordinary young people in India today. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, I've been to India, but that's not the same as being a young person in India. And, you know, in scholarship nowadays, we talk about the appropriation of voice and all this kind of thing, that I have no right to speak on behalf of, you know, or to pretend to be somebody else and so on. It's quite a complicated discussion, but it intimidated me, and I thought that I had no right to do this. So it was quite fascinating to me when all these people from India were saying, nonsense! we just want a good story. And I thought, okay, so what could I authentically tell? And I realized that, you know, during my life I've read many, many hundreds, like really many hundreds, mm-hmm. of old Indian stories. And it's one of the things I did, right, as a scholar, was study them. Yeah. And so they were very formative in my own understanding. I didn't just study them, they made me who I was to some extent. And that what I would really love to do, I thought, was to sort of tell an ancient Indian epic for young people, because the Ramayana and Mahabharata and all those old tales, though they certainly have elements for kids, they're mainly for adults. And I thought, so tell one, you know, for young people. And as you know, those stories typically do have a period when the royal family or part of the royal family is, you know, loses the kingdom and has to go into the forest. It's a major theme. And what happens in the forest? What is the forest? Mm. It's a strange transitional place where you have to face certain things that you might not have to face if you stayed all pampered and in on the throne. And so that's what I thought I would do. They're going to have to go through the forest. What's going to happen? And that's where these issues began to come up, which perhaps you wouldn't find in quite the same way in the old stories, namely that the forests themselves now are under threat. This was inconceivable, in a way, in the old days. Yeah. But it's conceivable now. And also the issues of women and women's power and what is that and so on. You know, I found myself grappling with that. And the challenge there is to try and, I don't know how to say this, to be true to the great call from women to throw off oppression. Right, mm-hmm. But at the same time, to do it in a culturally sensitive way, to not just rush into India with some kind of North American agenda. And how do you do that? Yeah. So this is all the difficult stuff that's being grappled with. But a lot of it's being grappled with subconsciously, because if you try and figure that all out consciously and say, I'm going to put in this and I'm going to put in that, then often it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, people just feel preached to, and it, you know, has to come from a very deep place. Yeah. So this passage occurs fairly well on in the story, and it includes a little story within a story, which is also very typical for Indian storytelling. Stama was disappointed. Walking by the river with Jaya, he had invited the famous bowman to join him on a hunt, and Jaya had declined. But why, said Stama, why don't you want to hunt? Prince, replied Jaya, I am honored that you have thought me worthy of your invitation, but I am out of the forest now, and I don't have to hunt for food. Therefore, I don't wish to hunt. But kings and high-born people hunt for sport, not because they need the food, said Stama. Exactly, Prince. I don't understand. Prince, said Jaya, have you ever heard the story of Dukkashara? No. Would you like to hear it? Of course. And so Jaya told the story. Long, long ago there was a king. His name was Mahabhoga, and he ruled in Udarapura. In due course, Mahabhoga's wife gave birth to a boy. The boy was born with a sharp, small arrow in his hand, and because this arrow caused his mother pain during the birth, he was called Dukkashara, which means arrow of pain. Now, shortly after he was born, the experts in signs were all assembled to predict his future. Some looked at the stars in the night sky, and some looked at the marks on the boy's body. All of them examined the arrow carefully with which he had been born. After discussing the matter, they agreed that he would become the greatest archer in the world. The boy's father was overjoyed. After all, what king wouldn't be happy to have a son destined to be a hero? So the king searched all over the world for a master of archery who would be worthy to teach his son. Finally, news came back from his messengers that the world's best teacher of archery had been found. The teacher lived far away in the northwest, in a land where people lived in tents and ride with great skill on the backs of horses. This man could shoot with longbows and crossbows. He could shoot with bows of wood, bows of metal, and bows of horn. He could shoot sitting, standing, and lying. He could shoot while riding on horseback or in a chariot. He was such a good teacher that he could teach more to a student by moving his little finger than a normal teacher could teach by talking all day and night. He was brought to Udarapura and asked to begin at once. The boy was now 1 year old. Now, the teacher gave the boy a tiny bow of bronze. Sticking a grain of cooked rice to the wall, he moved the boy 1 foot away, urging him to hit the grain of rice with his arrow. By the end of the day, the boy could do it. From that day on, the teacher increased the distance between the grain of rice and the boy by 1 foot each day. And each month, he gave the boy a stronger bow. The day Dukkashara became 16 years old, his teacher bowed to him and said, I have nothing more to teach you. It is time for me to leave. You can now hit a grain of cooked rice from 1 mile away, whether sitting, standing, lying, or moving. If you continue to practice, someday you'll be the world's greatest archer. Remember my teaching. Aim well, shoot as soon as you are ready, and if you are shooting a thing that has eyes, do not look in its eyes. From that day on, Dukkashara was without a teacher and had to practice by himself. This made him lonely. So he went to his father and said, Father, I am lonely shooting by myself. What if I were to join the royal army? Very well, my son, said his father, and the boy entered the royal army. Soon the army was campaigning up and down the length of the land, winning victories over all its opponents. Dukkashara would stand on a drum in front of his father's army with his huge metal bow, scattering arrows in all directions. After the first minute, all the enemy's best warriors would have fallen to his arrows. After the second minute, all the enemy's second-best warriors would have fallen, and so on. There was not a single army that did not surrender. Now, one day, when Dukkashara was 18 and his father's army had conquered its last enemy, the young man said to his father, Father, I am now the best archer in these parts. but there are many faraway lands. My own teacher was from a land far to the northwest. What if there lives in one of these lands a better archer than me? It is good to be the best, said his father, but it is acceptable to be the second best. No, cried Dukkashara, and he ran off to the forest to weep and feel sorry for himself. As he sat by a stream, he saw a doe walking with two of her young. Drawing a long iron arrow and fitting it to his bowstring, he prepared his shot. Just then, the doe turned her head toward him, and Dukkashara looked into her eyes. No one knows why he did this. His teacher had told him clearly not to. Maybe it was an accident. Anyway, he looked into her eyes and saw a light glowing there. He paused. What is that light glowing in the eyes? He wondered aloud, and the doe spoke. It is life, she said. Life, cried Dukkashara. I have been shooting the living? And he fell unconscious on the ground. When he returned to consciousness, night had fallen. There was no moon, and he had to walk back to the palace by the light of millions of stars. When he got home, he said to his father, Why did you not tell me I had been shooting the living? Why did my teacher not tell me? Tonight, I vow by the light in the eyes of all things that have life, I will never kill again. At that moment, a voice came from the sky, and it was heard even in distant kingdoms. And it said, A great archer knows not only how to shoot the arrow, but how to draw it out. On this day, Dukkashara has drawn the arrow of pain from all creatures, and on this day, he has become the greatest archer in the world. Now, Jaya finished the story, but Stama said to him, Prince, I still don't understand why you won't come hunting with me. And Jaya sighed. Prince Stama, our journeys change us. When I set out from the land of gold, I was one kind of warrior, and now I am a different kind. I hope you will think about these things. They walked back along the river. After a few minutes of silence, Stama said, Friend, there is something else I need to discuss with you. Yes, Prince? It has to do with the heart. The heart? Soon I am supposed to marry the Princess of Udyana. Good wishes to you both, Prince, said Jaya. Ah, Jaya, but there's a difficulty. A difficulty? Yes, another has stolen my heart. But haven't you promised your heart to the Princess of Udyana? Oh, Jaya, said Stama, don't pretend you don't understand. Surely at some time or other you've had your heart stolen by a heart thief. Jaya paused. Then he said, May I ask who your heart thief is? The Princess, of course. Princess? Princess Mati. Jaya stopped in his tracks, thunderstruck. Princess Mati is your heart thief? Of course. How could anyone resist her? Have you ever seen her smile? Jaya did not reply. Have you ever seen her frown? Jaya still said nothing. Have you ever seen her correct people when they make a mistake? Admit it, Jaya. She's the smartest, boldest, most beautiful woman in the world. Now Jaya was sweating. He said, Prince, to break your word to the Princess of Udyana would be a most serious matter. She would not be happy. Her father would not be happy. Her brother, whose nickname is the Killer, would also not be happy. And instead of receiving an ally and a large dowry, your father would receive nothing but the hatred of his enemies. Oh, said Stama, my mind understands you, Jaya, but not my heart. Will you not talk to the princess and urge her to return my love? It is impossible, said Jaya. Absolutely impossible, Prince. It would be improper. You must not mention any of this to Princess Mati. It's too late for that, my friend, said Stama, laughing. I've already sent a messenger to her with the greatest of all love poems. I didn't sign my name, but she's so smart she'll figure out who sent it. I wrote it in Sanskrit. And it's so difficult, I had to stay up all night to write it. In fact, I'm so tired I'm going home to bed, but I'm sure I'll dream about her. And before Jaya could say another word, Stama walked off to the palace. Now, meanwhile, in a room high in the women's quarters, Mati was pacing back and forth. It had been fun to go to the archery competition, But how annoying not to be allowed to join the celebration afterward. She had been made to visit a stupid lotus pond with the court women. These women were nice enough, but they had been taught nothing except how to flirt and please men. All they talked about, as they played silly water games, was which man in the contest had been the best looking. How restless Matty was. It had been difficult for her to admit this. The food, the clothing, it had all been so grand at first, but finally today she had been forced to face the fact she felt caged. Last night she had dreamt of walking through the forest. Animals moved quietly in the nearby shadows, her heart felt warm, and the flowering trees were singing love songs. Then she had awakened to the palace and to her dull, caged life. Now, as she paced her room, ready to scream with boredom, she saw a maid approach the door, holding something in her hand. The woman bowed and held out a folded palm leaf with a wax seal. It was a letter. Matty grabbed the letter without ceremony. Dismissing the maid, she broke the seal at once, and this is what she read. The title is Cruel Princess Matty, the Heart Thief, a poem in Sanskrit by an unknown admirer. And here is how the poem went. Every hero who looks at you, O divine heart thief, daughter of the goddess, becomes drunk with love, like bees who are stumbling all around, dizzy, because they have been drinking too much nectar from big flowers in the forest of many, many trees, or maybe a smaller forest. Your teeth are like pearls that strong, brave divers have got from the ocean, and they have brought them to the surface and sold them for a lot of cash, which they used to buy needed food and furniture for their cousins. Your eyes are like the eyes of a deer who is hiding in the bushes for some reason or other. Maybe she's afraid of the hunter. Or they're like torches, because they give off light like torches, or very large candles that are supposed to help show the path, but instead they are so bright that people fall down the stairs head first. Your teeth are as dainty as blossoms of the horse chestnut, and your lips are like the red flowers of the Pulit Mandara or the Rakta Pushta Pakovaradara, and are satisfying to a beloved person, like jackfruit or ghee. Your touch is like the touch of a goddess or beautiful woman who is walking through the forest unescorted and therefore frightened and longing for someone to protect her and accidentally bangs into an Ashoka tree, producing instant blossoms. Your frown is like Rama's bow, which is stretched as far as it will go to shoot an unsuspecting deer in the forest, who is not a normal deer, but a great stag who is brave and strong and heroic, like a prince whose name will not be revealed. So have mercy and be kind, O example of heart-stopping beauty, not to mention boldness, and do not torture the heart of a brave man whose name is a secret for now and whose love for you is horrible and would love someday to look at your face close up.
Oh, fuck.
What do you think of Graham Queen's book?
I love it. It's exciting, and it's like about a princess, and she's not like girly and stuff. She likes the wild.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really good. It's just exciting. Mm-hmm. Well, I like the characters. I like the setting.
I like the story. I like the part in the book. I wonder if it's real, because when they say you can train to climb trees like really fast. I want to see that real, because I love corn trees. It's fun.
Mickey. Matty, right, she's... I thought you'd like her.
Yes, she's, of course. She's my favourite.
Can you just describe how she is?
Well, she's a mathematician. She's a girl. It's just more interesting, because you know how they always have the boys do everything. It's just so boring. I can't stand it when they always make all these stories about boys. So I just like to have a story about a girl. That's one of the things I like about Lord of the Rings with Eowyn. Mm-hmm. Example is
she's smart and she's like quick. She's active and I like her. She's my favorite character in the book.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L 8S1CO.